Welcome to having absolutely no idea what we are doing here and figuring it out as we go along with it. I'm Alex.
I'm Ian, and we have no name. We decided on no name as of yet.
As of yet.
I figure that's something... Basically, I've done the whole wanting to come up with a name first and putting all this time into sort of the fluff of a project, and then just having the actual content end up being crap.
Because as you know, like any major project, any major undertaking, the name is the most important part. So that has to be first on
the
your
name
agenda.
And who your producer is.
Right.
So, but I figured with this one, I'm not all that concerned about a name yet. Maybe by the time we get a couple episodes in, we can figure out something good for it. But
exactly.
At this point, I just want to have some good content, I suppose, and then we can figure out all the details later.
The content is why we're here.
That's true. So, welcome. I have no idea who's listening at this point. Probably a couple of my random friends and a couple of random people who found us somewhere.
Kind of people who maybe knew me back in the day through Ian.
Oh, that's also true.
That's how I knew most of my people back in the day. Well, just in case, if you're listening to this for this. Basically, I'm kind of in the same boat as Ian, where it's been a few years out since we've actually kind of done anything musical related or anything like that. So about a month ago or so, I got this real itching listening to new music and whatnot, and just decided to send a text to Ian, and it's just like, you know, we're seasoned musicians and we're seasoned performers.
No, we are like, so far from seasoned musicians, it's unreal.
Well, it's all seasoned performers. If anything, we definitely performed.
Yes, we performed at Shepherd University and Fletcher's in Fells Point that is now closed. We're far from seasoned professionals or whatever. But yes, if you want to define seasoned professionals as ever playing a musical event ever, then yes, we are indeed. Yes, we're seasoned in Cumberland.
There we go. that is true, yes. Glorious Ahern's Arcade, if you've, you know,
true. So,
you know, professionalism is all about.
So you had been playing around with this idea in your head.
Yeah, I kind of just sent this text to Ian being like, you tried one time to do a podcast that one time. Like, I don't remember what happened. The one kid is like, why don't we try to do something like that? It's like, that could be interesting. Usually, like, when we're on trips or, like, especially, like, thinking back when we came back from California and, like, drove across country, it's like, we had pretty interesting conversations and whatnot about the albums we listened to and things like that. Why don't we just go start something up? I mean, we can start this, start up a podcast of our own and just have a conversation.
You might not remember this, but for some reason, one thing that sticks out in my head is, from that California trip, is us... I don't know why. Us driving through Arkansas or Mississippi or one of those southern states, but I just have this vision in my head of us driving on this like back road in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
I remember everything else. I remember the Saves the Day, the Shy Hulud, and of course the Fallout Boy days.
Oh, actually, that's another thing I remember. So this also, the random crap that I remember is absurd. But I have this memory of you and me. I don't know if you remember when we went to the Hoover Dam. There's really, really bad prep. So, like, leading up... Do you remember that at all?
Yeah.
We're leading... Going down to the Hoover Dam, if you actually want to drive over it, you got to take this, like, two-lane, really windy road that goes down, 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 down into the thing.
Just looking at hills, and then all of a sudden, it's like you turn a corner, and, oh, there's the dam.
Right,
oh.
And for some reason, I remember sitting in stop-and-go traffic there for way longer than I expected, listening to that Fallout Boy one with the, it's the first track off the one that has the Jay-Z, I don't remember what it is. Yeah, so you had sent me a text asking if I would be interested in that at all. And I love music. I love talking. I have actually toyed around with the idea from time to time of starting one of those online music review thing, just doing my own like blog type. And so this was an excellent opportunity. I toyed around with doing a one-person podcast too. And so regardless of what outlet ended up happening, I'm fully aware. I've surpassed the dreams of grandeur of the past. And I'm very fully aware that anything that I were to embark in would get absolutely nowhere. Do absolutely nothing, nothing would come from it. So it would be me. So when you had sent me that, I thought that was a fantastic idea. You and I, which got you to the California thing, anytime we go anywhere, like if we visit family, if we do whatever, We end up having just random conversations about bands and music. So when you mentioned that the first band we would cover would be Coheed and Cambria, I thought that that's perfect. Yeah. Because that's a band that I feel like you and I, at least in recent trips, have been talking a lot
they're
about.
They're so easy to talk a lot about because there's so much to take in.
So the basic concept of this podcast, assuming it gets beyond episode 2 or 3 or whatever, is to take an album each week and basically take it track by track. So our initial thought is to sort of play, you know, 10 or 15 seconds of each song just to give you guys an idea of what it sounds like in case you're not familiar with it, or just remind you of which song we're talking about, and then talk about anything special in that song that might be significant to us, or have that something in the song or something in the band or whatever lead us on a tangent where we end up talking about driving over the Hoover Dam and listening to Fall Out Boy.
Yeah.
Only time will tell, I think, with how strict we stick to the outline. But that's the concept. So this first episode, what album are we going to do?
This album that we decided on, we're going to start with the debut album from Coheed. This is, I believe it's 2002's The Second Stage Turbine Blade. I know about you. Was this the album that you were introduced to them with?
Kind of. So technically, as far as music itself goes, yeah, this was the first music that I listened to.
Okay.
But it would have been probably like 2004-ish. When did In Keeping Secrets come out? Because it was shortly after that.
I want to say that came out in 2004 because I first heard it in the, I want to say in the winter, the like early winter
like
of 2005.
Like
so
2003. Well, like we had talked about, when wasn't Second Stage Turbine Blade recorded in either their basement or their garage or something? Or am I just, have I kind of just jokingly?
Definitely what I think of the first two albums is the, you're right, the basement, the garage band sound. And, you know, like I say, it's the bane of the freshman and sophomore albums that record label is not going to invest a lot of money in that usually. And so it's usually the band's job, to really kind of break through that right. that barrier.
How much money can the five of us bring together
right.
to record something?
Right.
So to get back to your question, I was introduced to them through Joe Metcalf, I think.
Okay.
Who?
Oh yeah.
He and I shared a whole lot of musical discoverings, musical explorations, I suppose. but I remember sitting in his dorm room at UMBC, and I don't know if I had heard something or if I saw something that prompted me to ask him about it, but maybe he was listening. I don't remember, but basically, I asked about Coheed and Cambria. I'd heard people talk about them. I thought it sounded like kind of a stupid name, and it sounded like a stupid band, and so I was just kind of whatever. I wrote him off, and at some point, I asked Joe about it, and he said, well, they have two albums out, but you want to listen to the first one. He was like, the second one, they get really kind of weird. And, I mean, little did he know. You go from, you know, In Keeping Secrets to similar stuff they have now, they get just really, really obscure. But he was basically like, you need to kind of be eased into them. So I think he said, I remember some line like, if you listen to In Keeping Secrets without listening to Second Stage Turbine Blade, you're going to hate it. Mm. It's going to be too different for you, or something like that. So while I knew that they had a second album out, I knew that I was supposed to listen to the first album. So that's why I said I kind of indirectly was introduced to them through this album, or this was the first thing that I listened to. I think it was good advice. I think, you know, with the talent that these guys bring, regardless of how I got into them, I would have gotten into them eventually.
Yeah.
But I think it might have been a little bit harder had I gone straight into In Keeping Secrets.
Yeah, their earlier stuff definitely does. Second, not to get too much into that one, because that's the next episode, hopefully. But that's definitely the one where they started melding different styles together. And it's kind of hard to tell, because due to the limited production, it really doesn't. It's kind of like the early Shai Hulud stuff, where they didn't really know how to produce this kind of music, so it just comes across pretty flat almost, and like almost it's the sign of a really strong band that's strong live, but they don't quite know how to adjust that into a studio recording and make it into a dynamic involving recording. They know how to go full force in a show environment, and so when you get that into a studio, it's just full force all the time.
Because if you think about it, unless you're going to see somebody like Yanni or Enya or something like that, you don't go to a concert, much less a rock concert, to see guys, you know, do 20 minutes of, you know, nice and relaxed, easy stuff.
Right.
And if you go to get your balls smacked around and to get, like, pushed around and to have fun and to rock out, basically.
Yeah.
If you start out in that type of scene, even if you know that, like you're saying, that you want to come back when you make the album to have it have differences like that, it's tough, especially when you don't have the time and the money and the know-how to do that. I didn't realize that you hadn't gotten into them at that point. When was that?
I was so resistant. This was like 2003, 2004. I found myself enjoying it a little more. I found myself listening to the tracks a little more. So the summer before I left for college, I was out at the mall with some friends. It was like the last hurrah before going to college. You know, it's like total American Graffiti and all that. I had enough money in my pocket.
You're letting it all hang out at the birthday party?
You know it. It's not a party unless there's sheet cake, you know. And a pool party. Pools exactly and sheet cake. We go. And we had nothing to do. I found myself at the FYE and I was like, I have enough money to buy one album and I want to get either, I'm curious about what the Coheed and Keeping Secrets album sounds like, and I have this other album that I know that I'm going to like is Suicide Notes and Butterfly Kisses from Atreyu.
Well, that's another band. Well, we couldn't go through their whole discography because after two albums, really after the first album, it'd be like...
Shortest season ever.
Right. So really, that one, that artist will just be 1 week, and it'll be, this first album was sweet.
Man, we picked the wrong band for our first album. And I just like, you know what, I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to get this album, and I got the album, and I listened to it when
Which one was it?
Keeping Secrets.
Okay.
So this is the second album.
Okay.
And I listened to it on, this is when I was still living at home, and I lived like an hour away from school, and so I would commute every day, and so this album was just on repeat, and I just fell in love with it. And because
so you got started with In Keeping Secrets?
Yeah. And so roundabout way, that got me back to second stage when you told me that there was a first album.
Was that almost disappointing to you to go back to that first one when you had the second one?
When you listen to something like the first actual song on second stage, which is so time consumer, which is so well written, which is so...
Well, how about we play a little bit of that now?
Sure.
And then we can get into that.
What strikes me about this song is, first of all, I think I should just get right out of the way. You asked me if I would have felt disappointed when I first went back to listen to this album after In Keeping Secrets. And funny you should say that Joe had told you that you wouldn't understand In Keeping Secrets unless you really went back and kind of got this exposure first and eased yourself into it. It was the opposite with me. I got immediately hooked with In Keeping Secrets. But going back and listening to Time Consumer here, that sold that album for it. That sold Second Stage Turbine Blade for me, because to this day, even after all these albums they've put out, that still is my favorite song by them. Like, ever. What, I know
it's... The one we just heard?
Yeah.
Time Consumer?
Yeah.
What I like to do with really everything to an extent, at least when it's possible, is I like to figure out how to play them, how to play the songs. Mm-hmm. And Coheed is difficult because a lot of their stuff, it really is more picking and whatever. And I'm just kind of focused on getting the basic, almost like a baseline down, just the basic. What's the basic progression with it? And with Time Consumer, I remember I figured out just the basic, like I said, the basics of it. I was able to play it through. And then one time I came home and you played it for me and you played some weird, weird thing for the chorus. And I was like, no, that's not at all how the chorus goes. Right. There's none of this weird, like, slide up, you know, an octave and then slide back down and do it. There's not. It's just, like, it's pretty driving and whatever. And then it actually took me a while because I would listen to it.
It's deceptive. It really is.
I don't understand how they can get the sound that they get with that unless it doesn't sound like it's layered, like super layered or whatever. But I don't know. It's very interesting.
No, I know what you're talking about because when I first started learning it, all I was seeing in, because, you know, I learned from tabs, obviously, back then.
Right. And I still learn from Tabs.
Yeah, well, same here.
Let somebody else do the work.
I'm looking at the tabs, and it's just a bunch of, you're right, strummed octaves mm-hmm. and things like that. It's like the power chord shape with the strummed octaves, just a right. And I'm like, that's not what I'm hearing. What am I hearing? It's like, I had to actually, like, I can't remember where I got the chords that I ultimately got for that. But yeah, just
ended up... I think with a lot of that stuff, you were already skilled enough at guitar that I doubt that it took much effort for you to be able to figure it out. I'm sure you sat down and you go, this is what I'm hearing. Let me figure out here real quick what it is, and bam.
Realizing it was in drop D helped out a lot.
Still didn't know it was in drop D.
Oh, okay.
Maybe that's half my problem right there.
I do remember the first time I played that, and you were kind of surprised at that.
Oh, you remember
because
that?
I remember what it was, that you kind of dropped your jaw when you saw me do stuff, and you're talking about the... That's the part that sold me on the song and the chorus, is that they're utilizing that Lydian fourth, the tritone sound that comes, that comes over the fourth chord, and that just adds this aching sound to it. And finding out what the song is actually about in the mythology of the story he's writing just adds that sadness to it a little more. And
I think she grabbed whatever the first volume was. Whatever that first one was, a really thin one and whatever.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to read through it again and to see whatever. But I'm curious what you think this can sort of lead into actually the next song on the album. Hey, Shepherdy, New Jersey bound. You sound asleep, they'll find you at your most vulnerable. So I don't know how familiar you were at the time with the whole storyline behind the band, that whole actual Coheed and Cambria storyline, and they call them the Amory Wars.
Yeah. Back then, I think he was still unsure of it, so he called it the Bag Online Adventures.
Oh, right. Oh, I remember that, actually.
Yeah. But yeah, so, now it's the Amory Wars.
But Kaylee had gotten that book, and I was reading through it, and I kind of had this bit, not necessarily an epiphany, but just kind of a couple thoughts with things where it was, so the comic book, it seems like he didn't really have, he had a basic idea of what he wanted, but as far as being able to take that and take a chunk of it and conceptualize it enough to turn it into an album,
yeah,
it seems like he really, which is, he had a very difficult time doing that on Second Sight, on the first album.
I agree.
Which, like we've talked about with everything else with this, it's understandable when you're, you know, in the learning process. It's bands putting out albums like this, it's like getting to see them mature through, I guess, in public. It was like, so I was reading through the comic, and it's got all this, like, extra world or extra whatever stuff, like it's spaceships and whatever.
Space opera stuff and all that, yeah.
And then, randomly, there's, like, two pages or whatever of them in New Jersey. And some guy getting beat up. And there's no explanation as to how it fits into things. It's like you're reading through, and it's like page one, page two. Yeah, the very first thing. Page three and four, it just randomly, like, forgets that it's supposed to be space stuff and goes into New Jersey and whatever. And so I wonder, so I know that that stuff came out after, but I wonder if, like, how much of it he really, the album, as opposed to the later albums where there's kind of a, at least at the very least, there's an underlying theme.
Yeah.
With it, this album seems to be all over the place. When I read through that first comic book, I can't figure out what's going on, other than Coheed is there killing his kid, or is that who it is?
Yeah, Maria, my star, Matthew Goodnight. Yeah, it's
that's him. Like, they have some virus or something that he needs to kill because they need to get it out of, like, the family genes or something like that.
It's a mutation of his original virus. That when they mature to the age of, I think, like 18, it'll apparently cool a bunch of stars in their solar system that will cause the planets to all fall out of alignment that will literally destroy the universe. So they have to kill their kids in order to stop this virus from mutating and destroying the universe.
Right, and so, like, they're set up in this, like fictional, I guess later on you find out
the key work
or right. whatever in this whole big universe
yeah.
that they've made. And then randomly there's a song on the album about some guy getting beat up in New Jersey. And there's a part in the book, the comic, where just some random guy gets beat up in New Jersey.
Right.
And then it just goes back to the space stuff. And it's like, well, I understand you probably needed to throw that in there. I understand that you didn't quite get how to write this stuff yet. I mean, it's like if I were to try to write a comic
right.
book, I wouldn't have any flow to it. I wouldn't have an idea of really how to make it work. It would just be a random collection of ideas.
Well, this is the Star Wars world building thing that he's obviously trying to do, which can work to an advantage and disadvantage of when developing a universe and creating something like that. Like with the first Star Wars, it drops you right into the middle of this action happening. Princess is running away from these bad guys. You don't know who they are. You don't know anything about them, but you're dropped right into the middle of it. But it helps you along. And that's kind of what it is here. He kind of tries to use the one character that he named after himself, Claudio, as the protagonist. But he doesn't. The comic doesn't focus on him enough.
So it's funny that you say that, actually. You might have seen this interview with him at some point.
The band leader, Claudio, not
he was. Yeah, Claudio Sanz. He was talking about this album and how the conception was created. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's because I was watching an interview with him talking about one of the later albums.
Oh, okay.
And he brought back, they asked about, you know, how did the basic concept work and was it related to you personally and whatever. And he said, well, yes, loosely the characters of Coheed and Cambria are loosely based on my parents. But
right.
he basically said the character of Claudio was created because he didn't even realize when he was recording the music that he uses his own name in one of the songs. He said he went back and heard it and basically had a, oh crap moment. I just like yelled my own name a bunch. I got to figure out how to work that into things.
You know, that happens to the best of us.
So that's the thing. That's why I think that he kind of, he had a basic idea, but then when he went to execute it, it was just all over the place. I'm guessing, I really am guessing if you were to ask him about Devil in Jersey City, he would say that, you know, it was a song that they had from really early on in the band that he really liked, and they decided to keep it even though he couldn't find a good place for it to fit into right. the whole story. Where it also, it's kind of a, here's this song, okay, you heard it, now don't worry about how that fits into things. It doesn't matter. We're just going to keep on going like nothing happened. I have a very difficult time looking through poor production to finding there's good in there, like the diamond yeah. in the rough, basically. I hear poor production and I'm just like, this is terrible. I have no interest in listening to it.
See, that's the opposite with me. It takes me no time at all to listen to something and figure out and I think this is kind of what people kind of always have had a hard time dealing with me musically, is just because I'm not listening to the production values. I'm not listening to things like that. I'm listening to what is everybody individually playing in the grand scheme musically, what they're trying to convey. They're artists. Are they successfully conveying what they're trying to convey? And are they breaking through that barrier? And I remember the one show we played just north of, Waynesboro? Played at that little gymnasium. Do you remember this place?
Oh, yeah.
I had some massive...
Oh, we played there a couple times. It's the one with the fish tank.
I was going to ask about the fish tank. I don't know if you remember the fish tank.
With the fish tank? No. With the fish tank with the fish that was so big
yes.
that it couldn't turn around. So it was just facing one direction. It was like a big, long, rectangular, but narrow fish tank. And they just stuck a big fish in it. And when you look at it, it's like, that fish can't turn around. It's always facing the one direction.
Worst life ever. Here's music coming from behind, but he will never be able to know who is playing.
The tortures of a fish. Someone tapping me on the shoulder for my entire life and never being able to see who it is.
It's like, of course, you think that's the perfect place to host like a bunch of band shows, right?
That's it. Yeah. Judge that place, considering all the places that we've played before. Yes, that place is just awful. Well, I can't believe we should possibly play there.
Well, see, I felt bad enough about this story, and now that you brought that up, I begin to realize just how worse this sounds when I had this super complicated rig with like all these pedals hooked up that were like EQ'd out, like trying to get the sound. I think I was trying to get the sound from like the Shadows Fall album that I was listening to at the time, and that night it was just sounded bloated and just farty. That horrible like
the sound that everyone else thinks is good, and you're getting angry and pounding on your pedals and stuff.
Yeah, and I think after we play the show, I get up to the microphone and I think I say these words. I think I said, I apologize for how my guitar sounded tonight. Tone is a journey, not a destination.
Yes, and all the 16-year-old girls are sitting around going, what are you talking about? Does anyone have cigarettes?
And you just look at me and you're just like,
you played a gym.
Well, yeah, I'm sure the fish was impressed.
So I pulled us off the... Yeah, if we do that, we're going to have a 3-hour podcast where we get through 3 songs and then me yelling about a fish that can't turn around. I think that's exactly what people want to listen to. So I really like that song, and I think I really like every song in this album.
Yeah.
But I especially really like that one. With that one, I don't know, if you watched them play that song live before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know, and you'll have to correct me from a technical and a prissy, snooty high point on this or whatever.
It's what I do best.
I've tried playing that and other versions of that riff or whatever that's in the verse there.
Mm-hmm.
While trying to sing at the same time.
Oh,
and I noticed that Claudio does that a lot with that. Like, he has, at least for the verses or like sort of the quieter parts of it, he's the one that's playing those lead sort of more technical riffs while he's singing.
Travis, the other guitarist, is kind of just accompanying him on the bop, 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 but all the little stuff in between is just Claudio.
Right. And I understand absolutely the ability to mask that at a live show with, honestly, you could just do like palm muting.
Yeah.
Like you could just like just in a live setting, it would sound whatever. But if you listen to acoustic versions of that song or whatever, he's still playing at least enough of it to make it work.
Right.
And I don't know, like I've tried doing stuff like just, you know, tapping my foot along with it to try to get it. And it's really difficult for me. So anytime that type of thing comes up in their music, I think that it's really, I just am impressed.
If you want to talk about what, musically, what like really dominates a lot of their riffs in the first two albums, it's a lot of that double stops, the dun-dun, dun-dun. You'll hear that a lot in a lot of the stuff, in a lot of their music, especially the next album. I'm thinking The Time Consumer. Dun-it, dun-it, dun-it. Technically, the tempo isn't a 3.
I was going to say, it's a 2 over a 3-4 or whatever.
Yeah. And then for the chorus breaks into 4. So, I can definitely see the twistiness and trying to keep up with that while you're singing. Singing and playing basically two different feels at the same time. Well, that's definitely, I definitely get that from the Claudio end, and I know that's what a lot of people said when Coheed first came out, was from the vocals. And I think my personal opinion is that people said they were Rush for so long that by the end of the second album, they kind of became Rush.
It was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. No, what you were saying, I completely agree. This is a great, great song. One of the best on the album, in my opinion. This was definitely the, you watch them play live in any show, this is definitely the showstopper. This is the one that they, the earlier albums, on earlier performances. And that's one of the things when I came over tonight to do this recording, I think you were watching the Neverender performance.
Yeah, I didn't get through the whole thing.
But well, I watched it earlier this week, the whole thing, and it really struck me just how the songs are written so that they can produce the maximum amount of physical energy when they're performing.
Do you think that they were written that way, I suppose?
They came from that background. I mean, one of the earliest recordings I found of Everything Evil, this song, was them playing at Hellfest. They played Hellfest.
Yeah, I remember that, actually. I actually remember that.
They came from enough of a, like, hardcore thrashing background that people actually, like, had them on circuits playing with these bands.
Oh, that's
with,
very like, interesting. I had forgotten about that. But yeah, I remember seeing them.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where I kind of saw their name. I kept seeing their name pop up.
Yeah.
It was on, like, hardcore tours. Or
they, yeah, one of those, like almost filler bands. But, that you know, they thought enough that they put them on the... Put them on the roster and played, let them play. And that's just odd enough that they have that much of a thrashing background, rock out background, that they weren't always this thinking man's prog rock sort of deal that they are now. That's the one you were feeling.
That's what I meant.
That was Delirium Trigger?
That was. That's another. So I've been noticing a lot as I've been re-listening to this stuff that I don't know how to explain it. Like, it's intriguing. It has a lot. It almost has sort of a mysterious vibe to it. I can't figure out. I don't know if that makes any sense or not. It kind of has an ominous vibe throughout the whole album.
That's something they do really well on their albums is just create the mood and vibe of something bigger happening.
I've never noticed that before with this until we've kind of been revisiting this, and that I think that might be something that I really like with it, is that it does. It just creates this kind of not uneasy in a bad way, but just like there's something weird going on.
Well, Delirium Trigger is a perfect example of what we were talking about earlier about dynamics and about how they play it down so easily. The spin around the carousel when your horse isn't screwed in, that part is just very downplayed, and he has those very delicate vocals. Doesn't reach the
his voice gets just out of control high.
And he struggles on this one, like on when you see him live.
I'm sure he struggled when he recorded it.
Yeah. He's really hitting the high notes there, and his voice, it's obvious that this is like he's younger here. He obviously his voice is higher when you're younger at this stage. But yeah, he really challenges himself vocally on this one. Creepy foreboding, I think, is the word
right.
You're thinking of.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Well, you were saying in the comic how apparently this is the scene where creatures called the priests, which
I guess
are like wraiths almost from like Tolkien or something, and they fly into his house, and it's about Claudio coming home, finding basically his family murdered, his parents kidnapped, and he comes home with his girlfriend and pretty much gets attacked by this creature in his house. And that's pretty much what this song is all about, and that's pretty messed up.
It takes a very, I don't know if it's special, talented, whatever type of person, to be able to create a universe like this where it's just, I mean, it's so nerdy, and be able to have the confidence to do that to where you can get other people to get behind it.
Right.
In a different way than stuff like Comic-Con or Otakon or whatever.
Yeah.
It doesn't have that same sort of whatever to it, but being able to get people to get behind it like that, and also being able to incorporate personal aspects into it.
Yeah.
I think you had talked about before, a lot of his stuff, he basically has something that he needs to work through personally, and so he writes it in terms of this universe
mm-hmm.
that he can get out. And I don't know if that's sort of a... he can't get hurt if someone doesn't like this song. You know, that kind of takes a personal hit, where if you can sort of funnel it or launder the idea through this song about some like weird space aliens and space wars and whatever, then you can still get your point across while at the same time you don't have to put yourself...
No, that absolutely makes sense, especially like when a new album comes out and I'm try to assimilate it all in and try to understand what he's trying to say with it. I always think of it in terms of the story. I never honestly think of it in terms of what is he going through at that stage in his life.
It makes it that much more interesting, I suppose.
There's a lot going on there. I was thinking the same thing, listening to a lot of stuff I didn't really pick up on.
Well, first off, I don't understand what the intro is all about, other than they found a cool riff that they probably enjoyed vamping on in tour for like sound check or something.
Yeah.
Like, we need to throw this in here somewhere. We don't know how to write a song around it, so we're just going to put it in there, stop, and then just pick up another song where we... wanted to
use a Beatles transition,
right? Yes,
my exactly. Turn. Can't figure out how to write two interesting ideas together, and you just decide song A is over, time to start song B, and it's very awkward.
There's no transition like a silent transition.
Incidentally, I had a friend back in school who could do that exact scream, and he wasn't even a fan of the band, but he was able to pull off a scream like that that they use right when they...
What type of environment are you in where that happens? So I heard something also, I think it was, yeah, so it's the part with that scream in it or whatever. I heard like a bit of sort of that driving breakdown type thing or whatever that I think might be in these songs a lot more or whatever that I don't realize. Maybe they're not. I don't know. But if I could see how at least getting started, if they sort of connected with the right people or whatever, how there is that sort of loose connection with it, I suppose.
Well, yeah, and this song to me definitely is an example of what I was saying earlier about how they really come from. I do think they come from like the more hardcore screamo background, and this song's definitely an example of that. They've got the breakdown. He's doing a lot of interesting stuff with his vocals. It takes a very confident man and a very confident band to back a man who screams on his chorus, "I need mayo."
Well, yeah. Yeah, you want to start listening to a band that you are basically completely unfamiliar with, that you're going into like any other album that you listen to. And you hear crap like someone screaming, "I need mayo." You know, what are you possibly talking about? I had to have heard that wrong. And if I didn't, like, are you yelling about, like, you want a sandwich or whatever? Like, your turkey sandwich is dry?
That was a really rough day in his life that he had to write a song around it. Call me up and say, "You got to do your vocals right now."
You don't understand. I need mayo. That's another interesting thing where, like, how do you, what, where do you think the origins, if you had to guess, the origins of his names that he comes up with?
I learned pretty quickly looking into the comic books that he'll use words that don't necessarily mean what you think, what you're used to them saying. There are multiple Earths in this universe, so that's where you get Silent Earth 3.
Right.
New Jersey doesn't necessarily mean our New Jersey, because there's Paris Earth,
right.
Silent Earth,
right.
There's Jersey City, there's New Jersey.
Right.
There's Mariah,
mm-hmm.
the Angelica, and then there's Maria, his sister, who was murdered early on. And the character he's referring to on the chorus is Mayo Deftonwolf, who is sort of the Darth Vader of this universe.
Right, that's how I remember them.
Yeah, and Coheed and Cambria is it? I like those names. Those are very, they roll off the tongue really well. Claudio, Maria, Ambolina. He's really good at coming up with names like this, but no, he obviously takes what he knows and just molds it to what he needs. Well, the character Claudio's girlfriend, Nuo Ikken, it's his...
Oh yeah, Nuo too.
Well, Nuo Ikken is Nikki Owen, his girlfriend at the time, spelled backwards.
Oh, I definitely didn't know that.
Oh, didn't?
I definitely didn't know that. I had no idea that's where that came from.
Yeah.
What's the dog's name?
Oh, Apollo.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Back to my point earlier about him just being all over the place conceptually in this album. Mm. So it sounds like that one that are why I say that this is more of a straightforward kind of album as opposed to exploring unique writing ideas, unique composition ideas like they do in the later albums. This is very good. Excellent. I don't think there's an album on the song I don't like. This is just another...
I think you mean a song on this album.
What did I say, an album on this song?
Yeah.
Yep, there's not an album on any of this song that I don't like. Yeah, there's nothing, like, it's good, it's very driving, but there's not much to it, I guess, other than just being catchy. All of it is catchy.
This is the kind of song that I think every band should be good at being able to do. Just
write me a rock song.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what Devil in Jersey City also feels
yeah,
like.
Yeah, exactly.
Just a driving, straightforward, 3-minute, 30-second, not pop specifically, but just a driving rock song. And there is a place in the mythology because he talks about Patrick.
Right.
And that's Claudio's sister's boyfriend who has his own arc in the story. This is just something that they do this on subsequent albums. There are songs on the subsequent albums, and I can think of a few right now, that are just there to be almost relief songs.
Almost filler?
Yeah, almost filler.
But I mean, so I think this probably is Coheed filler. Give me a song to fill up a couple more minutes.
Yeah.
Because I mean, the album.
So let's
is...
focus on this nothing character and write a song about him.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Dear Nuo Ikken, how you doing? I hope everything's okay with you, but how's my dog Apollo? Give him my love.
I don't care about the human. I don't care about you,
kiss
but I care
my
about
head.
My dog.
Please tell him I won't be coming home. I'll be dead.
Tell him to kiss my Jew.
That was June Song Provision. That's a good tune. I like that one.
There's another one that, similar to Time Consumer, where kind of phrased weird or phrased whatever, and I remember you trying to teach me it. And it makes sense when you teach me it, but I cannot combine it or, I guess, incorporate it into the song itself. It's one of those where just the way that I hear it, the lead into it and the pickup notes where the band comes in does not hit where it should hit. And it frustrates me. I've tried to play this song a lot and it frustrates me every time. I cannot do it.
Well, when they reissued the album and gave the B-side with the stuff, they included an acoustic demo of this one. They used the Army of Darkness clipping.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah, this is my boomstick.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up. See this? This is my boomstick!
Good morning, sunshine, away from the sun, hits the sky.
The phrasing doesn't become any more understandable.
And it's funny because something like this is way more complicated for me to comprehend than most of the stuff on any of the subsequent albums.
Yeah, not a lot to talk about with that one. I mean, it's I think of it the same way I do Hearshot Kid Disaster. it felt the same as Hearshot for me for some reason. I guess I just thought of those two as being, if I had to cut out two songs from the album and replace them with something, those were the two that I could have done without.
I think the big difference with between those two is that this one clearly has, or at least I get the impression, it has contextual or I guess important, its lyrics are important to the story.
Yeah.
Like, it has a message in it that is significant and doesn't feel like I created a filler song that I need to put lyrics to it.
Or yeah. Whatever.
Like, this one seems, I don't know why, but I get the impression that it has more of a, like, this is significant, even if the song itself isn't necessarily.
For the record, that is definitely something that I admire about the band, that I like about them, which is, even if I don't quite connect with them musically, there's always something lyrically that I can connect with, and it, the opposite way as well. If I can't connect with anything lyrically that he's saying, I absolutely enjoy something that the band is doing musically. So there's always something to take away from them,
so
at least for me.
It's funny that you mentioned that. Lyrical connection thing. I have recently been listening to a lot of Sigur Rós. You're familiar with them, right? They are an Icelandic,
an
ambient sort of band. They're the ones that I had you.
Yeah. Okay, no, I didn't know that's what they're called. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I do remember.
I had you listen to them before. I showed you a video of them where the guy plays the guitar with the bow.
Yeah. They had like one maybe hit. One mainstream thing.
So they have a couple. So it's not necessarily mainstream.
Right.
One of the things that I love, the thing that really got me into them, is one of their songs is used at the end scene of Vanilla Sky.
Okay.
Which is how I think I first learned about them. But I read that their second album, which has the song that's used in Vanilla Sky, it's not called anything. There's no title to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it's titled nothing. It's not like it's...
doesn't have untitled as
it's not.
Title.
Yeah, it's not... what the heck is that phrase? Eponymous? All I can think of is epididymitis, and that is absolutely not... Yes, the album is Epididymitis. It means like it's named... Bands like, if you were Fall Out Boy, your album is called Fall Out Boy also.
Oh, eponymous. Yeah, that's the word you're thinking of. Okay,
so it's not that. It's not titled, untitled. It's not whatever. It just has no title at all. And none of the songs have any title. So
it's kind of hard to request on the radio.
Right.
Making you work for that album.
Right, exactly. So to further sidetrack a little bit, one of their things, not really a gimmick, is that they sing in Icelandic sometimes, but a lot of times they sing, he sings in gibberish. He sings basically in just whatever sounds good to him. Like melodic wise. It's the Kurt Cobain thing. The thing with Kurt Cobain was that the reason why none of his lyrics make any sense at all is because he wanted to worry about how it sounded first before what he was saying. So he would just come up with a melody and then just put a nonsensical word in there.
That's how David Byrne, the Talking Heads, worked.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He would just come up with what sounded good and then work lyrics.
Show me the funny. Wait, no, it's not
David
Byrne.
Lynch. Make with the funny. 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, same thing.
I know what you mean. If you've ever been in a jazz band and had to deal with a vocalist who's tried to scat, I completely understand what you mean.
Yeah, so it's that sort of thing.
That idea, that improvisational idea of just sounds. It's incredibly difficult to do gibberish.
But so his whole thing was that they put a booklet in the CD that normally has the lyrics and stuff. It was just blank. Mm. It had pages for all the songs and whatever, but it was blank. And the idea was each person was to listen to the song and basically hear what they wanted to hear out of the gibberish. And what do they think is being said? What lyrics do you think? Whatever. And then you write your own lyrics. And whatever it is, it can mean 10 different things to 10 different people, but whatever it is that you hear from it that you connect with, you know, that's what you hear, and you use the booklet to write out what it is.
Active listening, forcing the listener to actually draw their own interpretation from it. Don't give them anything to latch onto that they're familiar with, right?
All right, even if you listen to the stuff that's in Icelandic. I mean, if you listen to the Icelandic language in general, because it's nonsensical.
Gibberish in Icelandic, you know, it's kind of
right. It really, so really, honestly, when you listen to it, it sounds like they very easily could be singing in Icelandic.
That's kind of why Frank Zappa wrote a lot of his lyrics the way he did, was because they were, his thing was always, it's easy to sing lyrics with words that you've heard 1,000 times, with love and hugs and kisses and beautiful autumn day walking down the road and you were sad and all that's easy to hear that stuff. But when you have to sing a complicated text and melodies with words you're not used to hearing together,
right,
then it becomes a little more difficult. It forces the listener to become a little more active.
I think it would force the musician to become a little more active.
Sure. In it. Oh, absolutely.
So wait, he did all of that stuff purposefully to make it more complex than it needed to be? Just for the sake of being complex?
Not just for the sake of being complex. There is an actual, like, the guy recorded over 70 albums in his lifetime, and that'll be an interesting season when we do that one. but no, you actually listen to it. There actually is a mythology behind it. There is something called a Zappa mythology that actually there are running themes that appear song on different albums and such, and you won't actually hear him reference something. He'll reference something for an album that he hadn't even written yet. And I know that sounds weird, but it'll be an incidental vocal that will have been developed into something else on an album a decade later.
He's not referencing something that people haven't heard yet, but he's familiar with. He basically just says something and then later uses that. Is he saying it basically kind of a, I'm going to write something that pulls from this later on.
Right.
Or at least I want to. This sounds like something that I could have fun with.
It's kind of like why I love the show The Venture Brothers. It's because they can take a nothing background line spoken about a character you've never even seen before, and then 2 seasons later, introduce that character and spin it into a huge, sprawling arc with the character, and you suddenly realize that this character's had something to do with the plot all the way back from the beginning. And that's just something that, you know, when you can take that and really develop it like that, that I really admire about that. And that's something I think Claudio really did on this album, is that he kind of threw everything against the wall for his own invention, just to see what stuck, just to see what he could then take from it and develop further into the other albums. So when you say it's a very scattershot affair, I completely agree for that reason, because I think he's definitely working through not just his own stuff, but just the concept itself. So we're pretty much watching a guy create his mythology, listening to somebody create his mythology as he goes along. What's this next tune?
It's called Never Ender, and it's the second to last song.
Deceptive intro.
Yeah, no kidding.
Phrased differently.
That's what I was just thinking.
There's a lot of really impressive drum work on that particular song.
It's amusing to me that you and I notice the exact same things, because that's what I wanted to talk about with this song.
Oh,
it's hilarious. As I was listening to it, I thought this is a perfect example of why I love Josh's drumming style. Similar to how Steve Kleiseth from Further Seems Forever and Strong Arm and whatever, how he just has a unique style of drumming that I just absolutely love. Josh does stuff that is just, it's fantastic. It's not like, it's not super, super unique. It's just he has a ton of little things that make his stuff his own.
Oh, no, I completely agree. And it's, especially he's got those Neil Peart fills going on at the end there during just before the last chorus, but it doesn't feel like it's sticking out of the actual song. I remember one of the things people always said about Hendrix, which I completely disagree with, but people like to say about him is that when he switched from rhythm to doing his solo, you could never tell the difference. Obviously, when you're talking about a trio group where there's only one guitar, when a guitarist goes from rhythm to solo, it's the sonic equivalent of having the rug pulled out from underneath.
People said say that you can't tell when he goes from rhythm to solo.
Yeah.
How is that even possible?
I know. But that's one of the things about Josh's playing here. It never sticks out. It never feels like, here's the song part, now here's my fill. He's still playing melodically enough that it's staying with the actual overall feel and phrasing of his vocals and whatnot, but it's just accompanying them. It's just enhancing them more. And one of the big things I've always thought about this song that I wanted, that I was really excited to bring up here, is how much this song feels like an inversion of a rock song, in the sense that the opener riff, the big headlining riff, is really strong, really complicated, but then it gets quieter during the verse, and then you hit the chorus, and it's just really soft, quiet chorus.
Similar example for that, actually. We were talking about earlier, Tool, their, I don't know how you pronounce it, Anima album,
yeah,
or whatever, but the song itself is that exact same thing. The whole song builds up with this incredible tension, louder and louder and louder, until it gets to the chorus, and the chorus is an explosion of almost relief to where it's super quiet,
right,
and calm and just like peaceful or whatever. It's the opposite of how most of them are. Most songs start out that way and then build up to a really loud driving chorus.
Right.
Where that song builds up, and almost like you were saying, the bottom drops out of it, the rug is pulled out from it, and it just like falls apart into this nice, peaceful, quiet,
yes,
whatever. I hadn't actually noticed that with this song before.
The song feels very intimate, and it feels like he's really singing about something very personal here, and it just feels like one of his labors of love on the album, and it comes across.
It very well might be the case, considering they titled their tour after this song.
Exactly.
Not their tour, but their whole four albums and four nights thing after this song, so it must have some kind of significance to it. Another song with so many things to talk about.
I'm kind of glad I wrote down the track. There, you get lost in the song when you're really into it. You're gonna end
if you're gonna end an album in 13 minutes. This is how you do it. Gonna be succinct and wrap everything up in 23 minutes. This is how you do it. That's what Between the Buried and Me is doing with all their songs.
See?
They're being succinct and getting to the point and really just wrapping it up. So one of the things, I didn't get to mention it before, but Josh does it again in this song. One of the things that I love about his drumming style is that, let's say that they're in a beat that typically has the snare drum come down on three. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. What he does that I absolutely love is he adds another snare on four. So one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, whatever. And it almost, and he does it in one of the other songs on the other album, but it almost has a feel like he's turning the beat around.
Yeah.
But he never does, except for the one time in the other album. But I just love those little things that he does, because it's fun little things like that. Or sometimes he'll take a beat and just have it have a little fill or something that runs over to the next measure. Doesn't whatever, and it's things, just little things that I really enjoy with his stuff.
Well, it's kind of like what Stuart Copeland from The Police said about how he got so famous as a drummer.
Is that the guy that made Casino? He made Casino and he was in The Police. Maybe that's how he got in The Police.
I'm trying to figure out exactly where you're going, because Casino was Scorsese.
Oh, you know what?
And I'm trying to figure out who exactly you're mistaking me for.
Don't worry. It wasn't Francis Ford Coppola.
Francis Ford Scorsese Copeland.
You know,
guitarist for The Police.
All of your jokes can't be winning.
But he made an offhand joke when he was being interviewed about his drum set. I've seen this video, and he said he was kind of joking about this, but it was very interesting to think about when he's saying, he's like, you know how I got famous as a drummer? I took every beat, every drum pattern I have ever learned, and I took them and moved them one quarter note to the right.
Oh, that's awesome.
And
I wish I liked it too.
Next season.
Next season. Sucks. All right, that's this week's episode.
Who writes songs about prostitutes and Jungian philosophy? Every little thing she does is crap. That's it. No, I know exactly what you mean, especially on the intro.
Right, come down right on the bat.
Something sorely missing from an upcoming album when a different drummer took over. But to me, this is a great way to end this album because it's just, I did the teenaged angsty thing and my MySpace page name was Lock the Children in the Floor.
Yeah, I wondered for a long time what that was.
Yeah.
And I would have never understood that that's what he was saying.
I don't even know where that, why I locked onto that, but there's something about that outro, something about that ending riff that just has a real power to it. I don't even know why.
Well, it definitely wraps up the ominous feeling of the album, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Like, it's difficult. Well, he does it. I guess they do it in later stuff. He does a good job with it. But he takes such a high sort of fun-sounding voice and sings such sort of ominous lyrics with it. Like, if you look at it in terms of the whole space, whatever thing, his lyrics of... The world's not big enough for the both of us, and we live in the same town. Like, it's just another, like, what exactly are you talking
about? Yeah.
I know this has something to do with the story. Are you talking about, like, you're going to go off somebody? Like, what exactly?
Right.
What are you going to do? What's happening with this? And what I like about this song especially is that while it's long, the first, I don't know, half of it, third of it or so, it's almost like the spoken word stuff where they tell a story, where people just vamp on the same riff for 5 minutes while someone just tells a story.
Right.
He's basically just telling a story with whatever, but they change it up enough, they keep it interesting enough that it doesn't get boring. It doesn't sound, I mean, it sounds repetitive, but it doesn't get boring from that
record. Tears that pass away, sporadically ranged across the floor when you got it. It bounces around really well, but it bounces around like a poem more than it does actually. And of course, people see music, the lyrics is just poetry set to music, but not necessarily always.
Not
the
if you
case.
Listen to the lyrics that I wrote for The Lake. It's not poetry. That's for darn sure. Talk about gibberish.
What they usually did on their earlier stuff. They don't do it as much on their most recent stuff, but they would include a secret song.
So yeah, I guess while they don't end it with the acoustic song, they still do have one of their secret songs, which I can't decide. I mean, this album came out 12 years ago, so they get a little bit of leeway with it, but I can't decide if that is super cheesy, especially nowadays when you've got digital albums where you can see that there's a song or whatever, as opposed to something like Green Day's album Dookie, where... a secret song at the end of there. Most people turned off the tape and just flipped it over, rewound it or whatever. But no idea.
You know, using CDs back then, you know, the dinosaur days.
Boy, that loud, high-pitched wheeling or whatever it is, feedbacky sound in this, quite ear-piercing when you've got headphones. Well, I guess that wraps up Second Stage Turbine Blade from Coheed and our first attempt at this podcast.
I mean, if you had to pick what you thought was the, let's say, the three best tracks off that album, what would you vote for that?
I like Time Consumer. I like, you know, with all the crap that we had to say about it, I like Here Shot Kid Disaster. And Never Ender is fantastic. But honestly, it's one of those albums that, while with the Secret Song, it doesn't, if you disregard the Secret Song, it crescendos the whole way through and just builds up. Like, every song is better than the one before, or at least is equal to it.
Yeah.
You turn to the song and you go, this is my favorite song. And then you turn the next one on and you go, no, this is my favorite song. This one. Do you have a favorite that stands out to you on this one?
I had to say my three. Definitely Time Consumer is, to me, the best band. First track on the first album, man, it's never...
Track one, side one, album one.
I liked it before anybody else liked it. You know, I liked it immediately after her, but no, I liked it for its content. I liked it for its tone, for its arrangement, for the way it builds itself up. And that's something else I like about the two other tracks that I like. I definitely say Everything Evil and Never Ender.
Absolutely. Oh, Everything Evil.
I definitely say those three in terms of just arrangement and tone and conveying the emotion he's trying to convey. This feeling of a young, ignorant character, ignorant of the world, suddenly being forced into a horrible situation and having to grow up, definitely conveys that best on those three tracks.
That's interesting. I don't think I would have ever gotten that from you. It makes sense, and when you think of it in terms of that, it definitely works. So for our first attempt at a podcast, I think this was pretty good. So hopefully we'll be able to keep figuring out how to do it.
You know, if we gave the listener, whoever's listening, if we give you any inkling of interest in this stuff, any interest, please, by all means, seek out the album, support the band, you know, keep this stuff going. I mean, this is great stuff. We love this band. And if we've exposed you to something you haven't heard before, then, you know, all the better. You know, this album is from, I think, Equal Vision Records. So look them up. The Second Stage Turbine Blade, Coheed and Cambria. We'll adjust the format as we go on. Thanks for sticking with us as long as you have.
Yeah, just like this album and this band has been you get to watch them mature through their music, you'll get to watch us figure out what the heck we're doing as we continue on with this. So I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think that's the important part, and hopefully you guys did too. I guess with that being said, have a good one, and we will see you next time.
Hang on. Thanks.
If I have to hear Yamo be there one more time, I'm a Yamo blow my brains out.